I got an email. It was just like Rick Rubin was like the subject line. The real problem is they couldn't sit with boredom. It's a dividing line between success and failure. He's got like this list of questions. And one of them is, where do you get your dopamine? I'm not purely reading for enjoyment. I'm more reading as like a sniper. He said something like, I stumbled into like this profession where they pay you a fortune to do something I would have done for free. I'm trying to figure out like, what's my version of stoicism? What's going to be like my niche? And I'm like telling all this to Ryan. He's like, dude, you're trying to like map out the whole nine innings. Just throw the first pitch.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Billy Oppenheimer. Billy is the writer of the 6 at 6 newsletter and also a writing and research assistant for most notably Ryan Holiday, but also people like Robert Greene and Rick Rubin. We talk about research, writing, naive optimism, boredom, focusing on the work, working for legendary writers and creatives, and his first book. Please enjoy.
What was it that gave you the confidence, or maybe it was like naivete or naive optimism, that led you to reaching out to Ryan? Because I think a lot of, obviously he was a bestseller at that point. Millions of people knew about him, but I don't know how many people actually reached out to him and tried to do something like you did. What do you think was different about your mentality and wanting to reach out to him?
I think it was a little bit of naivete. Like at that point when I was writing that initial site, it never occurred to me like how you would go about growing a readership. I was really just like, I like doing this. I know my like family and my friends are reading it. And like in my mind, that was like, I didn't think beyond that. So I wasn't thinking, oh, this guy has millions of followers and I bet he's getting bombarded with emails. I was like, yeah, it was this ignorance of like, he's probably just like me. Like, who knows? Like, and learning about like how he did a version of that. Like he kind of just reached out. Or I don't think it was necessarily a cold email that got him the job with Robert Greene, but it was a similar sort of like, I'm just a fan of his work. Let me see if there's a way to help out. So I did a little bit of like I thought, I sort of pitched him on like, your books are sending me down these various rabbit holes. I'm doing all this reading as a result of the things I'm like, cause I was trying to sort of deconstruct his process. Like I would read his book and then I would read the books that he was citing from. Cause I just, as I said, I loved his style and I just wanted to figure out exactly how that worked. So I like to go to find the story, that he was telling, like the source from the source material. And I was sort of explaining this to him in that email of like, I'm doing all this reading. Maybe there'd be a way for you to like channel this energy into like a way that would be helpful for your future projects.
Right.
And he was just like, and I also quoted my, a philosophy professor. And part of my thinking with that was like, I want to show him like that I've got like taste for quotes, you know, cause like that's what I like about his writing. Yep. Was like the way he kind of pulls out these great one-liners and stuff. So I was like, how can I give him like quickly give him a feel for like, I've got a feel for his style and the stuff he looks for.
With any good writing, but I think in particular, the kind of style that you and Ryan and Robert do, it's heavy on the research side. And then of course you have to tie it all together. So you have to be good at research and writing. And within each of those things, there's obviously a million sub aspects. There's like the consumption, there's the parsing, with writing, there's the actual writing, there's editing. To bring it up to just two things though, writing and researching, which of those two would you say you enjoy more and why?
I love the researching. There's this, I think he's an entrepreneur, venture capital guy, Nat Friedman. He on his like about page on his site, he's got like this list of questions and one of them is, where do you get your dopamine? And for me, it's, I get it in the research process when I'm reading a story and the person who's telling the story has no, they're not thinking about a connection that comes to mind for me. And it's like, this perfectly illustrates this other concept that I read in this other book. And that's the most exciting moment for me. It's definitely the reading and then the drawing connections between things that previously like weren't fitted together.
I think that's the same for me in preparation for each of these podcasts. I really enjoy going and reading about, listening to whoever's coming on and the things that have inspired them. I enjoy the conversation, of course, because it's an opportunity to like actually put that into action. But then if you think about it as a cycle, I also enjoy on the other end, after we've recorded the episode, going and finding the snippets that stand out to me. So it kind of comes full circle. But yeah, it struck me that research was probably the thing that stuck out to you. What would you say are the cornerstones of good research? And I know I also want to get into the note-taking system that you've adapted from Ryan, I think Robert as well. But first, what would love to hear, like, what are the pillars of good research?
I think just reading widely, trying to read things that not everyone's reading. I feel like I read a lot of biographies that aren't necessarily the books that people are like, if you see a thread on Twitter, for instance, and it's like 10 books you have to read in 2024 or whatever. Like, I'm not really reading those kinds of books. I'm trying to find stuff that wouldn't otherwise maybe come on someone's radar. So I feel like finding things that people otherwise wouldn't come across.
Is popularity a con for you? Like, is that a reason not to go and pursue that source?
No, I also do read a lot of those books because I like to have a sense of like why things are doing well. So I do read all the Atomic Habits, Psychology of Money. Like, I love reading those books as well, and I really like those writers as well. But then combining that with things that are less talked about.
Barbell strategy of sorts.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to think of like some other pillars of good research.
And we don't have to make them up if other ones don't come to mind, but the curation question was one I had for you. Like, how do you determine the sources that you're understanding that unique or differentiated thought comes from differentiated inputs? How do you go about kind of curating those sources and then figuring out which ones to continue with? Like, because there's a lot of noise out there. You start to read it, you get 10 pages in, and you're like, yeah, this isn't the resource I thought it was going to be.
I don't know. I'm pretty quick to stop reading something. I am definitely looking for that. There's just this feeling like when you get roped into a good book. So I'm just constantly on the hunt for like that experience. And if it doesn't happen within like the first 10 or 15 pages, I'm not hesitant to just move on to the next thing. The other thing that one of the things I've learned from Ryan is like, one of the things I do often for him is he'll come across a story in one book. And then he'll ask me to find if this story's told anywhere else. And sort of triangulating wherever you can find either the person themselves or like other biographies. Because often if you read a story in one book, say it's a biography, that biographer might have left out a quote or a detail or some context that is included elsewhere that you will want to use in the way you tell it. And I've got a pretty good feeling for when somebody's telling a story, like this is definitely, you can tell that it's a story they've told before, and I want to go try to find it everywhere to see if they've used different verbiage or phrasing in different tellings that like will actually fit better in the way I want to use it. So hooking on to a story, but not like stopping there, going deeper and finding where else it's told. So if you see like in a lot of the stuff I do on Twitter, and I'll do like the first tweet and then in the second tweet I list like the sources I use, and almost always there's four or five places that I'm linking to. Like, I learned about this story first in this book, but then I also quoted from this interview, this other book. And that's something I don't think I would have stumbled into it if not for like Ryan showing me like that's how he does it. And I think that's a And you also can stumble into other cool stuff in like the search for the thing you're looking for. Like there's this quote from Shelby Foote, this historian. He's like, the number of things I found where I wasn't looking for them. And that's often an experience that happens is like, I'm going to track down this one story. And in the pursuit of that, I'm also stumbling on these other things that I'm holding for like, that I'll use elsewhere.
I think it's rare today also in the age of like this rapid kind of media cycle, people will hear something from one source and immediately go and share it out. And not a piece of this is fact checking, but the other piece is just like you said, triangulating, trying to get a full picture of it, trying to understand the consistencies, the inconsistencies, and being able to tell like this accurate story in the way you want to be able to tell it. But I think that's a rare trait nowadays. One of the things that enables you to be so well-researched and to draw lines across seemingly disparate fields and stories is this note-taking system that you have. And you have a great article on this on your website. So I won't make you reiterate all of it, but for those who maybe haven't heard of it before, if you could give like a primer or the SparkNotes version of it, because it's something that after I first heard about it, I'm starting to think about implementing because I come across so many good snippets here and there. And my tendency is just share it out on Twitter and I'll remember it. I'll come back to it later. But our memory is very lossy. So would love if you could just give a quick overview of that system.
Yeah. So the research I'm doing is mostly with physical books. So the process is, as I'm reading a book, I always read with a pen in hand, and I'm just like kind of making notes as I go and folding pages. And I'll often do this thing where it's like less than sign equal greater than sign, as kind of like this reminds me of this other thing. So I'll put stuff like that in the margin. And then once I finish the book, I'll put it aside for a week or two and then go back with a stack of note cards. And I go back through the book and look at all the notes, those folded pages, and anything that on that second read that holds up as like, this is really interesting, or this might be something I'll want to use in the future. Then I'll transfer that onto a note card. And I try to like put it in my own words, so I'm not just transcribing directly from the book. I'll try to have it be like it might appear in a future piece of writing, where like you lead in with a couple lines of context and then you quote. So I want to be able to just like do that work on the front end, so that in the future I just can like basically copy from the note card itself. And you often find that on the first read, I might fold over like 50 pages or something, but then only make 5 or 10 note cards. So that step of putting the book aside for some time is an important one. And like using time as a filter of what is actually interesting, or is like, I often think that a lot of the stuff I'm noting on the first read is just novel, and I'm attracted to like its newness. So letting some time like work on it and then going back, and if it still holds up on that second time, then it's more likely to resonate with others. So usually it's like, 5 or 10 note cards from a great book. And then I file those away in boxes that are kind of like loosely based on themes. And usually the themes kind of reveal themselves over time and like through the collection of a few cards that I've connected to one another, like then that becomes its own section. And I'll do something similar. Like if I listen to a podcast and I hear something like a good story or whatever, I'll note it in Apple Notes. Like I'll do a timestamp. I'll drop a link from the podcast episode and like a timestamp. And then every once in a while I go through that note in my phone. And then same thing, if something's held up as interesting, I'll transfer it onto a note card, and put it in one of the various boxes. And then once like there's 5 or 6 note cards in a section, that's kind of my cue. Like I've got enough here to go write about it. As you mentioned earlier, like I'm very, all of my sort of output is downstream of the research.
And so it makes sense for those of us who were wondering, how does he do this 6 at 6 every week? and tie together six seemingly disparate stories like together under this one theme. Is it as, I'll say simple, but obviously there's a lot of background work that went into this. Is it as simple as you sitting down, going and finding a section in your note cards that like stuck out to you? Or is there still a process of like, maybe I have this theme that's been running in my head and I have to then go find the six different cards?
It's almost as simple as that. So initially it was that. It was just my initial idea for the newsletter was when I sat down, I was like, I want to do a newsletter. What am I already doing that lends itself to like a weekly newsletter? And I'd been doing this note card system for about a year and a half up to this point. So I had a lot of material that was just kind of, I was sitting on. And my initial idea was just to like, I'm going to scan six note cards each week. And like, here's six things I stumbled on this week. And I did scan six note cards initially, and I just didn't like the way it looked. So I was like, scrap that. I'm just going to transcribe straight from the note cards. And the first like year of the newsletter was just six completely random. They had no, they weren't tied to one another. And then it sort of evolved into where it's at now, where I pick a theme each week. And yeah, for some reason, it didn't occur to me to like have them be all from the same section initially. I was just like, let me go through and find six that like jump out at me for whatever reason this week. And then it became the thing where I pick a theme and they're all kind of revolving around that theme. And now I'll, to decide what theme I do each week, usually on like, probably I'll do it later today. I'll go to the gym and sit in the sauna and just like kind of let my mind wander and kind of marinate on like the things I've been reading this week. Thoughts that I've been like returning to, any interesting concepts that are like returning to mind. And usually in that sauna session, I like latch on to an idea that's like exciting to me. And I start to think like, oh, I know I have this story that connects to that. And then sometimes I'll be like, that one note card that's in that other section actually works better with this concept. So then I'll go home and like go through all the note cards, and I'll find stuff that initially I placed in one section, but actually it belongs better over here. And then I sit down and it is kind of basically just transcribing from the note cards with a little bit of like editing to make it all flow. And if I'm calling back to a previous one of the earlier sort of bullets in 6 at 6, I might do a line or two that like isn't actually on the note card, but for the most part it's coming straight from a note card.
You said something subtle yet brilliant, which I think a lot of people when they start out creating don't get right, which is you tried to find a newsletter format that you could adapt from something you were already doing. At least that's the way I interpreted what you said. Like you already have this rigorous process that you're doing as a part of research for Ryan, I imagine. What was the genesis there? And so why go and try to invent something entirely new and spend 10 extra hours a week instead of just like, here are these things that aren't getting used, let me repurpose them. I think those kinds of constraints and like intentional use of things you're already doing is underappreciated and underutilized.
For sure. Yeah. And I was like, I want to be able to, I was worried about not having, because if I chose a newsletter format that like, if it was like, I'm going to do one like long essay each week. And I thought of that, but I was like, I can already see like how quickly I'm going to reach a point where I don't know what to do and I'll get really anxious. So yeah, falling back on like, what am I already doing? I'm glad I like thought of that. And then it did become, one of the things that Ryan, when I was thinking about, like, he was the one that sort of encouraged me to start putting my own work out there. And I was like, yeah, I've been like thinking about it, but I'm trying to figure out like, what's my version of Stoicism, you know, like what's going to be like my niche. So I've been like keeping this Google Doc and I'm writing stuff and I'm trying to look for patterns. And I'm like telling all this to Ryan, he's like, dude, you're trying to like map out the whole nine innings. Just throw the first pitch.
Yeah.
Like you'll find it through the process of doing it. And that was like, I think about that all the time, and I wouldn't have, it really was a stumbling into of the format that I now do for the newsletter. I love I love writing that newsletter each week. And I'm happy to where it's gotten to. So I think that's really, really good advice, is just like start doing it and you'll find like your style, or like your, I still don't really have like a niche topic that I'm writing about, but I have found like the style that I like to return to.
Yeah. I think finding like your, you can think about your competency in two ways. There's like the niche, the subject, the sector, the industry, but there's also like the methodology or the approach or the lens you're taking to it. So I think your competency, at least as an outsider, is your ability to connect these disparate dots across domains, and like tie things neatly together. At least that's what I appreciate. Your comment about just throw the first pitch versus planning out the whole nine innings reminded me of, I had a friend, Michael Ashcroft, on the podcast a long time ago, and he has this concept of archaeologist versus architect. And architects think about from the get-go, how do I plan out this entire thing over the course of multiple years? I need to know this. I'm obviously not an architect, but I need to know this brick goes here. Here's the floor plan, et cetera, versus an archaeologist is slowly digging up. And so like you should approach your creator, your creativity more like an archaeologist, where you're slowly putting things out, leaking them out. And then over time you'll find this, like this, the shape, the skeleton will emerge. And I think that's the right approach. A lot of people fall into like analysis paralysis, trying to figure out what it is my niche should be without ever having put out any work.
For sure. Yeah. It also, I was talking to, Austin Kleon, and I was sort of telling him about this, and he was like, one of the problems with having like role models, 'cause like I obviously really looked up to Ryan, but like you can learn the wrong lessons from them. Like I learned from Ryan, I took the wrong lesson from Ryan, which was like, he has his niche, I need to find mine. But like, I missed the fact that like he took 12 years to stumble into like that niche, right. You know? So I thought that was like,
journey.
Yeah. Like you have to kind of go back and see like how he got there. Like he didn't start out. If you go to like his early blog, like he's writing a lot about a lot of different things. And then similarly, like through just doing it, he kind of was the archaeologist in that metaphor of like, he got to that place, but, he didn't start out with like, I'm going to be the stoicism guy.
Right. Yeah. There's a bit of, especially when you're in an understudy or like apprenticeship position, in trying to learn from them, but also remixing with, or like injecting your own sense and taste and personality into it as well. And it's hard to, if you haven't had enough reps, figure out like, where do I draw that line, or what's the right mix or allocation here? But it comes over time, and it sounds like you're inching closer to that if you haven't already found it. One thing I thought about is reading about your, as I was reading about your note-taking system, was that you could interpret that approach to consumption as like very kind of mean or end oriented. Like you're just trying to read this material so you can find that one excerpt that I can put away in my note stack. Does this approach, are you able to straddle those lines where you're reading for the enjoyment of reading, but then also finding those things to pull out? Or does it ever take away the enjoyment, just always looking for that next snippet?
It probably does. Like I have to admit that I'm not purely reading for enjoyment. I'm more reading as like a sniper or something. Like I'm really going and looking for stuff, but like that isn't enjoyable for me. Like I love, like I said, like the dopamine hit for me is like when I find something, and I think I actually enjoy reading more now than I ever have, because I have, it's a forcing function, or having the newsletter that like I've, and the reason I called it 6 at 6 on Sundays, I want it to be locked into like when it goes, not only what day, but what time it goes out. And the newsletter, because it's like set in stone that it goes on 6 o'clock every Sunday, like I have to constantly be reading and like filling up the tank of material that I have to draw from. But I do love the, I do love the like hunting process that is reading for me now. And I like my girlfriend is a big reader, and she like never takes notes. Never, she'll like show me something. I'm like, how you're gonna forget that? Like, and it gives me anxiety.
Drives you mad.
I'm like, you gotta like make notes. Like, aren't you gonna want to remember that? But she is truly reading just for like the joy of reading. So I think, yeah, there's just like different ways to enjoy that process of reading.
Right. Yeah. There's no right answer then there. And you can also do both. I have, I know you've said one of the things I wanted to talk about maybe a bit later is how you've said you don't really spend a lot of time on fiction. I think understandably, just like in your, both for your newsletter and your work with Ryan, maybe that's changed over time, but I think in a previous podcast episode, you had said that. But that is for me a way I can get both, is I get the entertainment from kind of the fiction, and then I am looking for those lessons, those excerpts to pull out and more so the nonfiction and podcasts and such. There's kind of this journey that people go on when they're trying to become creators. And I mean that in like the broadest sense, when you're trying to create anything, not just kind of try to be an influencer, but there's like three C's. There's like the consumption period, there's the curation period, and then I think there's like the creation. And I think more and more I'm seeing curation and creation as kind of blended. They aren't as black and white as some people might see, but I think there is a clear step for some folks on the journey to creation where you're just curating, you're just pulling out excerpts. Do you feel like you have started to kind of cross that chasm into what I'll call, it's not really pure creation, but it comes more from a, I guess, quote unquote, original place than it is just finding these things and plugging them in? Or is that a place you don't even really feel like compelled to get to? Maybe that's more of something that like a fiction author does or a director does if they're working with fresh material.
Yeah, so when I think of like curation, I think of like, here's 10 things that I read that like, I think people will like, but like, they don't really tell you. So like the newsletter, my style is kind of curated, but like, ideally you don't have to go read the source material to get something out of it. Like if I just curate a bunch of links, I still have to go do the work to like get the experience that the person who's collecting those links seemingly had to like compile them. It's like, I had a great experience reading these. Now you go read them. I want it to be like, I read all these things. Here's like my favorite parts from them. Here's a link to it if you want to go further, but like, this is the best story I found in this book. And then the process of like the weaving things together that weren't put together before like feels creative to me, and like I don't know, I feel like those are two different.
Yeah, and I'm saying this to poke the bear a bit, to be honest, because the reason I enjoy your work, the reason I brought you on, is because I think you do exactly what you said. You're a step up from pure curation. You're providing your own opinion or lens, and the weaving of these ideas together is the creation. It is the remixing.
But I get what you're saying, because it's like, I'm not like, there's really nothing I've written about that's like not borrowed from someone else.
You could maybe say that for everyone ever. Written anything genuinely new?
Yeah.
I don't know. He said it in a different way.
Yeah. But yeah, that putting those things together in a way that like, it's like no one else could have thought to put these things together, because like no one else has like read all these things in the order in which I did. So like, it's one of the things I like to do with like some of the stuff on Twitter, is to like break down how things get made. And it's usually a version of that. It's usually like, I noticed this thing over here and this thing over here, and those two things where I've curated them, but in the blending together made this new thing that like only I saw how they went together. Yeah. And I like read, like Morgan Housel is one of my favorite writers, and I have no interest in finance or investing, but I love the way he tell stories and makes those connections. That's like no one else could have thought to put those things together. So he's also another big influence on me. So I was also thinking of like, not only what am I currently doing that lends itself to good content, but like, or to consistent content, but what is it that I like? What's a pattern in the things that I love? And like a pattern, one thread between Ryan, Robert Greene, and Morgan Housel is that like storytelling to illustrate things that weren't previously put together.
Yeah.
So that really was like the second piece of like that clicked in for me of why I did the newsletter in the style that I did. Because that's just what I like to read.
Yeah, it comes through. You're definitely doing it. I would group you with them as well. Morgan's in kind of my Mount Rushmore as well.
Yeah. Yeah, he's so good.
So good. One of the other things I thought about as I've been reading your newsletter now for a year or so, is it's one thing to pull out these snippets that you really enjoy for the sake of sharing them out with other people. How intentional are you about trying to like internalize and apply those concepts to your own life? Because every week you're thinking about, here's the central theme, but here's six different stories. And these are things,
yeah.
Should I be trying to apply this week?
Yeah. Yeah.
How thoughtful are you about that?
I wouldn't say I'm like necessarily like, okay, today I'm going to go apply the theme from December 12th. But I do think it's like, I was reading this profile of Greta Gerwig, the director, the writer director.
Yeah. You had a great piece on her recently that I love.
Yeah, she was asked, because she's obviously making like fictionalized movies. And she's like, are they purely fiction? And she was like, no, they're like ostensibly memoirs. Like they're made up in the literal sense, but they all like nothing happened, but it all rhymes with what happened. And I was like, that is perfect when I heard her say that. 'Cause it's like everything that I'm drawn to somehow rhymes with like something I experience or that like something that I do on a day-to-day basis. They're like, when we say something resonates, it's like it resonated with something that I've experienced or I've felt or believed. So I think everything I couldn't be attracted to it if it wasn't something I'm doing or that I want to, or that I'm like aspiring to do. So I'm not necessarily sitting down and going like, let me go put these in action, but it's like, yes, this is what I believe. And like, rather than sharing that belief directly, I just think it's like more enjoyable to read a good story. So I think everything that I'm writing is like either a reminder to myself or like something I want to start doing or have experience and just like hadn't been able to articulate before.
That ironically resonates. I feel that,
yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about that. And I think to add on to that, there's one aspect, which is you feeling pulled to the thing because it resonates with you. But there's also, that's maybe a bit more of like an awareness to it. I think there's also another piece, which is it kind of seeps into your subconscious and there may become a point in the future at which that thing you remember, oh, I read this book a while back. I need to go back and revisit it. Now I'm seeing
totally
where that would make sense in my life.
That happens all the time. So I just did this post on John Mayer. And it was so about, I was listening. I'll often like put on YouTube, I'll put on like one of his live shows and just listen to it as I'm working. And I was listening to one of those shows and there's, you know, like sometimes between songs, so like banter a little bit. And he's pretty like, he's got kind of like a comedic, like philosophical mind. So sometimes it's like the best stuff in those videos are like when he's like introducing a song and giving the backstory. And like, and in one of those backstories, he was talking about like how he has this rule in his life where he never wishes for less time. And he's like, everything you love and hate leaves at the same speed. Done, done, done. So like wherever you go, just make a home right there and do that thing. And I've been sitting on that story for months, and I was like, there's something here, but I don't know what to do with it. And I know it can be good, but I didn't want to rush it out. And then I was preparing to interview Mark Manson last week. And in one of those interviews, he was raving of this book, Stumbling on Happiness. And I was like, I've heard of that book. I've not read it. Let me go read it. And I'm reading it. And the first chapter is all about this concept of prospection, which is like the mind's tendency to think about the future. And John was saying, like, I wait for most things to be over. Like, I'm here, but I'm really thinking about like what I'm going to do next. And I was like, oh, that's the other takeaway, is like this concept of prospection. And it finally, like, those things came together, and that post did really well. And I'm glad I like didn't, because I was like, when I initially heard that clip, I wanted to post it right then, but I was like, I want to get this right. So that happens all the time, where like I draft something up and it just doesn't click in for some reason. And then months, sometimes like a year later, I'll read this other thing and go, oh, that's exactly talking about like this other thing.
I appreciate that you sit on that. I'm one to definitely, as soon as I found it, if it clicks for some reason, I go and share it out. But that, yeah. to go into that video for a second, I saw it a couple of days ago when you posted it. This is a topic I've been thinking about a lot over the course of the last year, is how much time we spend either regretting or reliving the past, or fantasizing or fearing about the future, and just sacrificing the present all the time.
Yeah.
And the moments we might be a little bit more present, we're thinking about how do we take the present and get to like this arrival in the future? Like, how do we get to this state of resolution where we've achieved something, that we've gotten there? And yeah, just perpetually sacrificing the present. And it's one thing to like say that and know that you're aware of it, and another to actually live it. It's just a constant reminder. But the way in which John said it really resonated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also is like kind of one of my theories of things that do well on Twitter, is combining a known and an unknown. So the reason I was drawn to like his explanation of like waiting for things to be over, and I think why a lot of people resonate with that post, is like, that's a very familiar experience of like, I'm here, but I'm thinking about like, what am I going to do for lunch later today? Or like, I'm working on this thing I need to do, but like, how nice is it going to be when it's over and I can just like sit on the couch tonight? So there's that like known of like, this is a familiar experience. And then the unknown was like this concept of prospection, of like the psychological reason like we do this, and combining those things. If I look at like a lot of the things that do well, there's often that aspect of like a familiar and an unfamiliar thing, and bringing those together is like, I think when those things click in, it's like exciting for a reader.
Yeah. I think there's another element to the known and the unknown that, as you said, it brought to the surface for me, is you could have gone and pulled, I mean, how many people have gone and pulled something from like Eckhart Tolle about like, be here now. It's like it's the same idea. But for some reason, when you go and pull it from a different source, a different domain that people see in a different light, but tell this generally the same idea, I'm more likely to go and read what you put out than I am to go and read that excerpt that you know, I've seen 50 times from somebody else. I just associate with Eckhart Tolle. But this known unknown concept is, I know I kind of hijacked or repurposed it a bit, but I love your explanation of it. Maybe the final question around six at six, are there, and I'm asking a lot for you to pull this off the top of your head, but are there particular themes that you've consistently revisited or have, and probably this is changing over the course of a year or something, so maybe it's more recently, but are there recurring themes that you find in your work that you're drawn to time and time again? And I know it's very open-ended, but
yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm definitely drawn to like just how the creative process, how like creative things get made, and like deconstructing that. It seems to be a common theme in various like concepts that I explore in the newsletter. Mindset stuff. Like I did one recently on like this performance psychologist, Jim Lohr, Dr. Jim Lohr, I think is how you say his last name. But he has this line about like the power broker in your life is the voice no one hears. Like that voice in your head. And he worked with athletes for like a decade, and he would have them wear a microphone and articulate the way they spoke to themselves in competition. And he was like, the impact that had was like a revelation for him. Like he had never heard it like put that way before, of like this power broker, like this, the way we speak to ourselves is very powerful. But that also combined with, it's not just like a manifestation thing of just like lying to yourself or being like delusional. So I try to like, when I did that piece, I specifically called out, like, of course, like if all you do is tell yourself how great you are and you don't like go act on it, that's like the word for that is delusion. So I wanted to talk about like the, in all of these examples, the mindset was important only after like the work that they put in. So, and that's, that kind of is another one of my sort of favorite topics is like, the process, the work that you put in, I do find that I was listening to an interview today of Bruce Springsteen on Howard Stern's show. And he said something like, I stumbled into like this profession where they pay you a fortune to do something I would have done for free. And that seems to be a common thing among the people I look up to, is like, you do get the sense that there's no amount of money you could pay them to stop. And that's kind of like a cliche thing to say, but it does seem that the people that like were least aiming for like success and awards stumble into it as like an unexpected natural byproduct of just like, I like doing this thing. And I feel like I've already won because I get to do the thing. Like that's definitely a theme I return to again and again.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I like how you used the phrase stumbled on. That reminds me of the video you put together of Rodney Mullen. He maybe embodies this more than anybody else. He's just like,
for sure,
I'm just out here skating like that. Yeah. That's it. Anything. And in fact, he tries to reject like the external validation and praise. He's like, it's purely about the skating, which I think is hard for a lot of people to retain over time. You start to kind of defer to or look to the audience for that validation, but keeping yeah, it like within the craft and letting that be enough.
For sure. But it's a weird tension because I also like, especially as like a writer, like you do want your things to land with other people, you know,
that's
like
the,
you
don't, that's just the only way you become noticed.
Yeah. But you also, it's like, it's fun to know that this thing that interested me also resonates with other people. And you do like, if everything I was posting like flopped routinely, I would probably step back and be like, what's not working here? And it's like, I'm interested in a lot of different things. So I'm willing to like, keep this thing to myself if I keep hearing that, like, that's not landing with other people, and like, I'll just have that. But like, where's the overlap between what I like and what's landing with other people? So you do, it's hard to like completely just be about the work. Like if it's not resonating, I do think it's like valid to use that feedback. And it's not like, it's not what's the word? It's not completely like this purifying, you know, like the art or whatever. It's, it should land with other people.
Yeah. As long as you're not going as far as to pander to them exclusively, it's like trying to strike that balance between.
Or like this, the concept of audience capture, like it can definitely be taken way too far. I'm reading this biography of, Marie Curie, the scientist who discovered radium, and it's written by her daughter. It's really good. She in a chapter about when she won the Nobel Prize, it's essentially about like her daughter has this line about like, you never heard Marie Curie complain until after she won the Nobel Prize. Like, and she lived in like poverty and she had like this crazy upbringing and she had a lot to complain about, but she never did until like the thing that like got to her was when the sort of secluded life she lived to do her work, when that got shattered, it really like messed with her. But then her daughter has this line about how like she never stepped into the character the public tried to make her. Like the press, journalists, photographers were all hunting her down to like celebrate this great scientist, and they kind of like form this caricature of her based on like these small details of her life. And it is easy to like step into that like character. And I just love that line of like, Madame Curie never stepped into the character the public tried to like put her into. And you do see when that happens, when the person steps into the character that's like working on YouTube or whatever. And it's like, it goes to this crazy extreme where they're totally captured by the audience.
How do you, if you have any inclination, I mean, you're starting to get to that point where you're, maybe you'd still consider yourself kind of niche famous, but you've got, you know, an audience of six figures. If and when you publish a book, which I want to ask you about in a little bit as well, that'll bring some more kind of attention. I'm curious how you protect against that. And I'll throw in as an aside, there's this awesome bit. I don't know if it's actually been verified, but I heard this once that Marcus Aurelius had somebody by, actually you would know better than I would. Marcus Aurelius had some guy by his side that he exclusively hired for the purpose of telling him, you're just a man, whenever anybody would give him praise. Might just be a tale or a myth, but like the idea of kind of grounding yourself and bringing yourself back down and remembering like, this is about something else. This is about the work. But yeah, curious how you protect against that.
Yeah, I don't know. I've not been like really deliberate or like thought too much about it. I don't know if I'll have a good answer to that. I hope.
But you studied a number of people you would consider great who have been in this like predicament, right? And you've seen people go either way. You've seen people just completely succumb to the result, and other people, it sounds like maybe Madame Curie was a bit like this, stuck to the work.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it may be a sort of nurture. No, maybe it's just a character. Like, I'm very introverted. I kind of, not dread is too strong a word, but like I would prefer sitting at home reading or like small group where I'm with people who have similar interests and we talk about the stuff that like, I sort of write about and like the people who I admire, like those settings I look forward to. But for the most part, I prefer solitude and not, it's hard for me to imagine like getting excited by like going out and being like, I don't know, like your fans.
Yeah.
Want to praise you. Like I just, the thought of that gives me anxiety. So I don't think, and who knows, maybe in a couple of years we'll look back and somebody will clip this and be like, he totally went off the rocker. But yeah, I don't know.
Fair enough. So you've spent, how many years has it been now since you've been working with Ryan?
Five, coming up on, okay. Yeah, almost five. It was like late 2018.
Okay. So you've spent about 5 years with him. You've done a ton of work for and with him. You've got your newsletter in an incredible place. I'm sure you're working on other side projects, one of which I wanted to ask you about in a bit. But I'd imagine the next kind of major milestone is your own book.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. And so curious to hear first if you are working on that. And in either case, like, what are the signs or the feelings you're looking for to take kind of that next leap, that next step in your career and go out on your own?
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. As of 3 weeks ago, I did sell my first book.
Congratulations. That's incredible.
Yeah. Thank you. To Penguin Random House. And it's going to be, the imprint is Portfolio, who also publishes Ryan's books. And I started to hear from agents and publishers and stuff early last year. And I would always send this stuff to Ryan, be like, hey, do you think this is worth exploring? Like, would love your thoughts on this kind of thing. And for the most part, he'd be like, it's cool that people are expressing interest, but I would just keep doing what you're doing. Like, I think it's not time yet kind of thing. And then middle of last year, I got an email from Penguin Random House, but it was their UK house or like their UK branch or whatever. And they were just like, hey, we read your newsletter. We love it. We're wondering if you have any book ideas. And I sent that one to Ryan. He's like, this is legit. Like, I know who this guy is. But this is when you would want to start to talk to an agent. So then I started to have some calls with different agents, and I ended up signing with Ryan's agent, Steve Hanselman, who's been awesome. And he was like, it's cool that the UK is interested in your work, but you would never want to sell first to the UK. Like, you would want to get a US house interested first and then sell the rights separately to the UK. So I was like, okay, that's good to know. But like, in the meantime, I'd sent the UK publisher kind of like a rough outline of this idea I'd been kicking around, and they responded. They were excited about it. And I think they like wanted to do a deal like right then and there. And Steve, the agent, was like, no, like, let's put a fuller proposal together and then like take it around. And so that's where I started to do. And then he called me like a couple of days later. It's like, hey, did you send that document to Adrian? And Adrian's the president of Portfolio. And and I was like, no, I didn't send it to him. And he's like, well, he somehow got it, and he likes the idea, he wants to do it. But we still went like a traditional proposal route. So I spent like 3 or 4 months fleshing out this proposal. It was like taking that sort of 4-page document into like a 60-pager that's more fleshing out the idea and sort of a marketing plan and all this kind of stuff. And then we did end up going with Penguin Random House. But so yeah, I'm chugging away on that as we speak. Well, not as we speak, but it's in progress for sure.
That's incredible. Yeah, congrats again. It was just a matter of time. Is there something in particular that made you feel like it was the right time? Was it Ryan kind of signing off on this outreach being a legitimate thing? Or was there something you were feeling personally like, okay, I'm ready to do this, or maybe a combination of?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of like really trusting in like his thinking on it. Like, if he would have said it's cool that Penguin Random House reached out, but I still don't think you're ready, I would have listened to that. So it was definitely a combination of like trusting in like what he thought, and then also just being excited about this idea. And like it has been something I've been hooked into, and like subtly, like a lot of the stuff I've been writing has been like with an eye towards this concept, and like testing it. And and I do, I, yeah, it's just something I was like, this is an idea I think is has enough there for a full book, and it's something that I've got material already, but I'd be excited to go like really deep into like the research on this and because a book is like, and I've gotten to see the process with Ryan stuff, and then we've done some like ghostwriting projects together, and it's really like a 2-year like commitment. So if you're not really jazzed about the idea, it's going to be, you're better to wait till you do get something that hooks into you. And this was an idea I'd just been like, I kept returning to. And when the publisher themselves were excited about it, then I was like, okay, cool. It's sort of validated by people in the industry who know what they're talking about. And then I'm excited about it. Ryan's supportive. So it's kind of all of those things.
Anything in particular you can share around the book, whether it's the title or the premise,
yeah,
or maybe read us the first chapter right now?
Yeah, the introduction's written. I don't have the first chapter figured out yet, but the title is "The Work Is the Win," and it's a concept I've, I think like my 4 or 5 best performing posts on Twitter and LinkedIn all use that phrase somewhere in there, and we sort of touched on it earlier, but like, how do you get to a place where you get most of your satisfaction from the work itself? And as I was saying earlier, like, I do think I tend to find this pattern of like those people also, as kind of a natural byproduct, just liking the thing that they do, they also get those extrinsic metrics or those things we associate with success, like recognition, money, awards, tend to come as a byproduct of just being about the work. So it's going to be partially about like, how do you find that work? Or if you're kind of stuck in a spot where like you don't have that, like, what's a way forward? So I'm kind of deep in a research cave on it right now. Like, I feel like a little bit overwhelmed with, I know there's something really good here. Like, and I'm a little bit anxious of like, will I be able to pull it off? Cause I am really excited about the concept, and I think it could be helpful for a lot of people. So I hope I can get it right.
No question. There's an audience for it. That is, I think, at least for me, a big part of why I follow your stuff. You had said earlier when I asked you about what are the major recurring themes for 6 at 6, you said two things that stuck out. One was like deconstructing the creative process. Mm-hmm. And another was around like this idea of the process. And I think those are those two are very interconnected. Deconstructing the creative process, at the end of the day, it is about the work. Like, that is mm-hmm. the unit of creativity, just compounded over time. So at least from an outsider's perspective, I think that's the right topic and the right thing people go to you
yeah.
for. What, can you talk a little bit more about that sense of like fear? Is it that the work won't live up to like the standard that you now have for yourself, or the taste you've developed, or what is it about that? That's
no, it's like, scary. I'm anxious that like, I'm not going to find, like, in the research mode, I have this like nagging thought that like there's concepts and stories and ideas that would fit perfect in this book, and I'm not going to find them. So there's a
even
little bit
with
of that.
The mountain of research you've already done.
Yeah. Yeah. Even
over
with
the years.
That.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm like really trying to cast a wide net in the research process. And then just like, I really do think it's a concept that could work well in a book, and I'm worried that I won't pull it off. Or like, I feel really good about the structure that I laid out and like the idea for the book. I just think it's like has the potential to work really well and be like a great read for a lot of people. So yeah, there's this part of me that's like, I've landed on a good idea. Now I have to execute, and I hope I can do that.
The silver lining is that's a sign that you're at the edge of your comfort zone, which is a
yeah.
good thing. Well, that's exciting. I'm super.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm ready to hit the buy button on that pre-order link whenever it's out.
Yeah, I would love to get your maybe after we jump off, I'll send you the intro and get your thoughts on it. Cause, yeah, I'm trying to get some, as much feedback as I can.
Please. I love that. You'll have to take my feedback with a grain of salt, but happy to give it. The other project I was interested in, I heard maybe it was on Danny Miranda's podcast that you had said that at one point in time, somebody in Rick Rubin's circle had reached out to you and was talking about working on something. Did that ever come to fruition? And if so, anything you can share on that?
Yeah, I've been working with him. A little over a year, I guess. I wrote this thing on Twitter about like sort of what I was describing about getting interested in Ryan's work and just going deep into the rabbit hole. Like a similar thing happened with Rick where it was before his book had come out, but Ryan actually writes quite a bit about Rick Rubin in The Perennial Seller, the first book I read. I think that's where I first learned about him. And then I read that there's this like short little biography called In the Studio with Rick Rubin. And I somehow read that, and then just like any interview I could find online, any podcast he had done up to that point, I was just like obsessed. And then I put together this thread of like 10, creative habits and practices, or 10 habits and practices for doing your best creative work from the legendary music producer, Rick Rubin. And it did well. It was well received. And I got an email. It was just like Rick Rubin was like the subject line. And I've gotten similar emails like that, or like similar subject line emails like that in the past, where like I'll write about someone and someone will email me and it'll just be like, I read your piece on Rick Rubin. I really enjoyed it. And I thought that's
nothing,
what that
nothing
was.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah. And I saw that. I pulled up my phone and like saw that email, and I didn't open it. I was like, I'll respond to that when I get to my computer. And I get to my computer later that day and I open it. It's like, hey, this is so-and-so from, I work close with Rick. He saw your tweet. He really liked it. He wanted to know if you had some time to talk about some things he's thinking about. So I had a call with him later that day, and he gets on the Zoom call. He's like, first thing he asked was like, tell me how you came to work for Ryan Holiday. And then he like takes a step back. And I told him this whole story of like, I was traveling, I started writing, and someone recommended one of his books, and I read it, and just that sort of whole story. And then he comes back up and he's like, you mentioned you were traveling. Like, where'd you go and why were you going there? And then he stepped back and I tell him this whole story. I was like, I played lacrosse in college and I went to Australia to coach and play there. And then just kind of got the travel bug and went to Colorado and skied, and then learned that a lot of the Colorado ski instructors like go to the southern hemisphere for their winter. So then I was going to New Zealand and chasing winter year round. And then in that process, I started writing, and tell him the whole thing. And he comes back up and he's like, you mentioned you started writing. What were you writing about? And like, why did you start writing? Told him about that. And then he comes back up. He's like, I don't know what I was expecting, but this is not what I was expecting. And then he started telling me about like what he, part of it was like his podcast, Tetragrammaton, which is now like off and running. But it was at that point, he was like just kind of kicking around the idea and wanting some help on like the research of guests and preparing for those episodes. And then, so I help him with that kind of stuff and like writing the copy for, he does these really cool ads on Tetragrammaton where, he has like kind of an AI bot, like read it, and it like one of them's like read by like Orson Welles' voice.
Yeah, it's a novel approach. Love that.
Yeah, it's really cool. And his like, I was asking him about it because I've never like, I was like, how did you think to do that? And he's like, well, as I was thinking about the podcast, like everyone I talked to said like, well, you're gonna have to read ads. And he's like, I don't want to read ads. And he just didn't, it didn't feel like it, he didn't feel comfortable reading, like doing the sort of what most podcasts do of just like these ad reads. So he's like, what would be a way to do it that like I would feel good about and like would be like creative in itself? And he just landed on this concept, and he's like, it's become my favorite part of the podcast. And I've like, if you look at, you know how on like YouTube, if you like scan over the bar of like the watch time, you can see like where people are replaying. It's what a lot of people are replaying those ads. It's really interesting to see. But that was a cool lesson. Like, what's the way that it's currently done? And like, I don't really feel good about that. How can I make it? How can I still like do this thing, but do it in a way that feels good to me? And then with Tetragrammaton, he does have this like, he's wanting to not just be like a podcast, but kind of some other things on branch out on that, under the umbrella of Tetragrammaton. So I'm working with him on that kind of stuff as well. And then he's been kicking, he hasn't landed, exactly on the next book, but I do think like he's kicking around like wanting to do another one at some point. So it's very similar to like the early, when I was starting out with Ryan, where like Ryan would just randomly send, hey, could you like track this down? It's very similar to that, where like the podcast stuff is pretty steady, but, and then randomly he'll be like, hey, could you research this for me and like put together something? Like for instance, he's really into the I Ching, which is like an old, I think it's like thousands of years old. It's like one of the original Chinese texts. And there's various English translations, and in each of the translations, the chapter headings are slightly different. And I think it's 64 hexagrams is how that book is broken up. And each hexagram has like a name. And in all the different US translations, that name is slightly different from translation to translation. And he called me and was like, hey, could you go through all the translations and just like put those side by side? And he was like, I just want to like spend some time with it and see what comes up. So I like went, I got like all the different translations and then like put this like big table together so he could see them side by side. But it's just like random stuff like that. And it's cool because it's stuff that like I otherwise wouldn't think to go like look into. And he has very vast and interesting taste in like what he's consuming. So I'm kind of as a, just in the vicinity of that, picking up a lot of stuff that I otherwise wouldn't think to go read or look into. So it's been really cool.
What an incredible opportunity. And again, kind of fortuitous timing where it took off like right before he did Tetragrammaton and his book, which it, I mean, I have to imagine, at least in our circle, that book might be the most shared book of the year. Like I've heard so many people talking about it. And so for you to kind of take that that trajectory, that slope with him, is pretty incredible. And I think there was a few more, there was a number of things that were bouncing out around in my head as you said that. One of them was the bit on Orson Welles. So the earlier in this episode, you had talked about naive optimism, and you may have actually shared this, but there's a clip of Orson Welles in an interview talking about how he became the director he was because he didn't grow up in the industry. And I'll have to share it with you if you haven't seen it.
It's right. Yeah, I haven't seen it.
How, because he was an outsider from the industry, he didn't have all like this institutional knowledge and kind of developed habits, and he was starting from scratch from first principles. So that was an interesting connection.
That's a very there. Rick. Yeah, that's, I think Rick would really connect with that, because I feel like I've heard him talk about that with the music industry, where he was just like a fan and wanting to like, he didn't have the industry baggage. So he was like innovating in that industry. Not, he wasn't like, hey, let me go innovate in the music industry. He's like, let me just make the things I want to make. And like, as it happens, those things were innovative, but it was a similar thing, like where he just didn't know any better.
Right. And that actually, that dovetails into the other thing I was going to say, which is, there's a lot of like intertwined or intersecting ideas here. I'm scanning through sometimes at night Robert Greene's, I think it's Interviews with Masters. It's not the book itself. It's like the actual raw transcripts. Yeah.
It's like Companion to Mastery or something.
Yes, exactly. And I'm reading the one with Paul Graham right now. And so much of the conversation is about how Robert is trying to not necessarily put him in this box or say, like, this is what mastery looks like. But it is a bit of like he has this predetermined list of questions he wants to ask Paul to see if he fits this archetype. And yes. Time and time again, Paul is like, no, I don't, like, that's not me. That's not me. And he's like, literally all I did was I just wanted to avoid all the bullshit I didn't want to do. He's like, that's how I got to where I am. He's like, I wanted to do this thing. I didn't want to do this thing. And now I'm here. And that reminds me so much of, like, from what I can tell, I started listening to Rick's book, but haven't read it all the way through, but like how he's gotten where he is. He's just like, I am who I am. I can add value in this way. And I'm going to avoid the stuff I don't want to do, like the podcast advertising.
Yeah. Yeah. The I am who I am thing is like, it was because I had listened to so much and like read so much about Rick the first, and I have since spent time with him in person, and it was surreal to be like in a conversation with him face to face, but it felt a little bit deja vu because it was like, this is exactly how he is on a podcast. And it was like, and as I've sort of thought and reflected on it, what I've like kind of landed on is he just is so comfortable and at peace and accepting of like the person who he is that it doesn't occur to him to turn on like different versions in different settings. It's just like always this one Rick Rubin. And Robert Greene is very similar in that way, like almost childlike, where, yeah, they don't think to like, oh, I'm stepping into a public setting. Let me like turn on a performance. Like, it's just like, this is who they are. And it was really cool to like see that.
That ties back to what you said earlier about Marie Curie as well. Not like accepting that character.
Yes. Yeah. 100%.
I feel like for so many of us also, we develop different personas that we like implement in different settings or areas of our life. Like the true sign of authenticity is where you're just like yourself through and through. Mm-hmm. And in fact, for Rick, at least in the episodes I've listened to, he actually can make people uncomfortable where he's just like, he'll ask a question. And just as you said, like you talked about him sitting back or walking back. And I think it was the episode with Whitney Cummings in particular, that I listened to that, like, I mean, she talks a lot as is because she's a comedian and that's her job. But I could tell, like, he made her a bit uncomfortable in the way he just sit back and didn't try to like inject himself. And that's like it's a fascinating quality to have.
Interesting. He was on her podcast?
No, the other way around.
She was on. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
I
he might've done hers as well. So I was curious which one you're talking about.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. And I may be projecting a bit here, reading into it too much. I know we're a bit over time already. There's just a few more things I wanted to throw your way.
I'm good on time, so.
Okay, awesome. So you're coming to this interesting stage in your career where you're publishing your own book. I imagine there's a number to follow after that. And maybe in the next few years, you're going to start thinking about needing your own research and writing assistant. Having done that role now for 5 years, what are the key qualities or traits that you'll be looking for in that person? What makes a good research and writing assistant?
I think this is actually something Robert, I asked him a similar question because he's talked about this, but he's struggled to find a research assistant since Ryan. And I think he's pretty much given up on it. And he's had dozens of research assistants over the years. And so I asked him like, how did it not work out? And he sort of thought about it for a second. And he started to say that like some of them couldn't grasp the spirit of his material. Some of them just didn't have a good eye for like story. He was like, I look for kind of drama in the stories that I resonate with, and they just didn't have a handle on that. And then he kind of like stopped and thought some more. And he's like, but like the real problem is they couldn't sit with boredom. And he said, it's a dividing line between success and failure is the ability to sit with boredom. And he's like, the writer's life is very boring. And the things I'm asking those people to do are very boring. And if you can't sit with that boredom, it's just not going to, it's not going to work out. And that's partially true, but also for Robert, it isn't boring to sit down with the biography, you know, like he gets excited by that. And same with Ryan, like they get excited by what appears to be boring to a lot of people is actually very enjoyable for them. And I don't know how you would assess this in a person, but if there were a way to like quickly find out, like, can they do this tedious work and get some enjoyment out of it, then they'd probably be a good fit. And maybe one way, like what I've thought about is the first thing I would maybe do is, if I were looking for a research assistant, I would think like, cause I get emails, not all the time, but somewhat consistently of people just being, hey, I read this thing. It reminded me of this other thing you wrote about. I thought you would like it. And that's basically like the job of a research assistant. is finding like interesting stories that resonate with the things that person writes about. And I do this all the time, right? Still with like, I send Morgan stuff, from time to time of like, hey, I read this story that like reminded me of your chapter in Psychology of Money. And it's one, a way to like, I think they appreciate it, but it's also just a way to like continue to hone the craft of like looking for good stuff and to like test it. Like, does this person think this is good? Because it's been one of the like valuable things about working with Ryan is like through the process of sending him stuff that he rejects is how I've honed like my eye for what's good and what isn't. So I would first think like I can right now think of people who have sent me stuff like two or three times, be like they I would maybe reach out to them and be like, hey, I'm setting out on this project. Do you have any bandwidth to like go hunt some stuff for me? So I think, and no one, I don't know, I don't think you'll ever see like an author that's like, I'm hiring a research assistant, but everyone is like looking right for help, you know? So you can just like start doing that job. You don't have to like wait for a job application or something like, and I feel like if you did post about it, you would actually get a lot of the wrong people. You would get the people that like actually want just the reward of having a post do really well. And I've seen this like with people we've tried to bring on to help out with some of the stuff we do with Ryan's stuff. They have a misconception of what the job is because Ryan's output, he's always publishing. And if you're on the other side of that, you just think it's like what you see that gets published. But most of the work is not that.
Yeah.
And most of it is tedious and boring. So the person, a lot of these people come in with this idea that like, oh, we're going to be like publishing these clips on YouTube and they're going to do millions of views. It's going to be awesome. But it's like, where do you think those ideas are coming from? It's like hours and hours in like a biography that most of the time that you actually spend a lot of time, that's like seems to be wasted because you don't find anything. And that can be very discouraging for people. So yeah, it's like the ability to sit with boredom and that ability to spend a lot of time that you don't know if it's going to pay off. I feel like those are the two, you really need those two things to like be a useful research assistant.
Yeah. And there's a foundational or an innate element to that you can't train for, which is, you said earlier something to the effect of like, what's your obsession or what's your compulsion? You had a better way of phrasing it that I think you took from somebody else.
But oh, the dopamine.
Yes. Thank you. You have to get the dopamine from the boredom. Like that's a non-negotiable.
Yes.
You got to start there. And then you can potentially train somebody on like, what are the best practices here? If the person doesn't have that, that's unteachable. And it's a non-starter. Which is why I think, to your point of most people, even if they were listing positions for research assistants, wouldn't find the right people, is like, actually they should come up organically like you did, because they were so interested in the thing that they felt compelled to reach out. That's probably the best way that it's going to surface or bubble up.
Yeah.
I love that quote on boredom though. That's great. I'm going to co-opt that.
I also think that's just like a good strategy for like finding the work you should be doing, is like go immediately to the boring aspects of it and see if like you like those things.
Right. If that's stuff you're going to have to wrestle with day in, day out, if you don't like that, then the good parts of it aren't going to be enough.
For sure.
We mentioned Rodney Mullen a bit, like midway through this episode.
Yeah.
There's a quote that you've used in a couple places of his that I love, which is, the trick is to always peel back and ask, why am I doing this in the first place? I imagine, given you've used that quote a couple of times, you've thought a little bit about this question. So what is your why? Why are you doing this in the first place? This being very open-ended, but thinking in particular about the writing, kind of your career, your work.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a compulsion. I don't know. It's a good question, and it is something I should have a better answer for, because I do love that line from Rodney.
I think it's interesting you say it may just be a compulsion, because that is enough. Like anything on top of that would be a post-rationalization. It's like, I don't know, I just feel like I got to do it. Like I feel called to do the thing. And either people could say, I don't know the answer, and it's because I'm just following the script that everybody else has been telling me my whole life, and I need to do this thing. Or the other end of the spectrum is like, no, I feel compelled to do it. Like I got to do it.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
It was definitely not the former for me. Like for the last 4 or 5 years, most of the people in my life thought like, what are you doing? You know, it's an easier, like the, what do you do conversation is easier to have if people are aware of Ryan's work. But for the most part, it was always like, what are you doing? Like, but yeah, even through that, I never was like second guessed it. I was just like, it does feel like a little bit of a compulsion to do it. And I don't know, for some reason, I just like the act of researching and hunting for stuff and drawing those connections. When I was like younger, I would, I have two older brothers, and like, if they had ever sort of like pick on me or we'd get in a fight or whatever, I would like kind of retreat to my room and like stew on it. And I would think like, oh, I should have said this. I could have like annihilated them with this. And I often think about that, because it's similar to like what I do now, of just like stewing on material and like, what is the best way to express this? I think I'm naturally drawn to it. For some reason, I don't know.
Yeah. And you get to express those things in a more like manicured, edited, refined way than you would in like the heat of the moment, just blurting it out.
Yeah. Yes. And in a way that's hopefully like useful for other, like me just going back and like putting down my brothers is not useful for anyone.
Right.
But it does feel like a similar, like, let's go sit on this and like, what is the best way to express it?
Yeah.
That's something I really like doing.
Very cool. Well, in closing, I ask everyone the same final question, which is to turn it back around on you. Hopefully I didn't prime you for this too much with the last question, but what's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
What seems to be boring to most people that you really enjoy? and how can you do more of that?
Excellent. I think that ties kind of a through line through everything we've been talking about here and your book.
Yes.
Well, awesome. Thank you, sir. This is a blast. I'm glad you can make the time on a Saturday. Looking forward to playing this one back.
Yes. Thank you for making the time as well. We've been kind of trying to get this on the books for a while. I'm glad we made it happen.